Honestly, you're such a...
Subcommittee on Human Services, Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Today is April 15th. This is an informational meeting on four topics. We're going to start the meeting with a discussion of housing issues. Ms. Van Vliet, can you come up? Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, all of the presentations today will be on housing issues and across some various agencies, including housing and OHA and DHS. And each program will talk a little bit about how housing works or is affected in their program. And then there's, I'm hoping, will be some really excellent discussion about how programs intersect.
Thank you. And committee, some of you have heard me speak about this individually, just in conversations, that often we look at things in silos and sometimes even in separate subcommittees or separate policy committees. But when the programs overlap, I think it's important to have an overview of how we are serving Oregonians through these programs. And I'm very pleased that we were able to design, to set aside a whole day for this kind of a meeting, to get a better view instead of only some piece of something that might happen to come through our subcommittee when it's really great. They're all related. Ms. Van Vliet.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'm really excited to be here this morning to talk about my very favorite topic, which is the importance of housing and how it relates to other sort of human service related policy goals. So what I'd like to be able to do this morning is just give you a high level overview of the housing market from our perspective and show you a bit about what role we play within the larger housing market at our agency. And again, I think that will probably prompt some questions and some good dialogue and set us for, you know, moving forward towards really integrating our programs. So while in Oregon, we are very much looking at the intersections of housing with the education system, with health systems, with reentry, and various human services pieces, I wanted to just call to your attention that nationally, this conversation is very alive as well. And so I just cited here for you a couple of places where we've seen that, for example, foundations, think tanks, if you will, and national media are really exploring these same intersections that I think are of interest to this committee. And so we try and pay attention to what's happening outside our, you know, the state of Oregon as well, and just find that these kinds of other resources are also very interesting and helpful to us as we think about driving alignment and integration. So I want to just walk you through kind of a basic overview, and some of you are very familiar with this, but we'll drill into it a little bit. In my world, as sort of housing practitioners, we talk about a continuum of housing resources. We very often talk about the homeless problem and the homeless system. And that includes, you hear phrases like chronically homeless or situationally homeless. Those are two different kinds of cuts at the homeless problem, and there are two different sort of types of populations who typically fall into those situations. We talk in that world about things like emergency rent assistance, or a new sort of phrase is rapid rehousing. We hear a lot about investments in shelters and things like transitional housing. And there's programs that match up to those, and we operate some of those programs, and community-based partners do their own work in the homeless system. Then sort of moving up the continuum, we talk about rental housing. You hear terms like permanent supportive housing. I'll talk more about that in a minute. There's actors like public housing authorities that administer public housing and Section 8. Those don't come through state government, but they're an important part of the overall continuum and the overall system. Then there's publicly funded apartment buildings, and many of those get funds from us, but some get funds from the federal government, and we don't touch those. And then there's privately owned apartments and small buildings that are just naturally affordable. And then there's the home ownership end of the continuum. And we talk about the importance of home ownership in that realm in terms of asset building, wealth creation. We also, of course, in recent years have had a number of programs aimed at helping people keep their homes and avoiding foreclosure. So drilling into the kind of the rental housing part of this continuum, again, there's these different actors, and state government plays really a relatively small role in the overall rental housing system. The private market is, in fact, where most people get their rental housing needs met. They're owned by private landlords. Some are low rent just naturally because of the market situation, but they are considered affordable. Anyone can access those. Private landlords typically don't restrict by income or other kind of eligibility criteria who can rent from them. And this is a place in the private sector where Section 8 or housing choice vouchers are accessed. So people get a housing choice voucher or a Section 8 voucher from their local housing authority if they're lucky, and they can take that into the private rental market and rent from a private landlord. The other part of the system that I think it's really important, and many of you know this as well as I do, that manufactured home parks actually are part a really important part of the whole rental housing market. And while many people own their manufactured home, they rent the space that it sits on. In the affordable rental housing sphere is more like the things that we do at my agency. Very often they're owned by a nonprofit, but also nonprofits own this type of housing. When we put in our funds into it, we require long-term guarantees of affordability. This is also, again, in the context of public housing, other kinds of publicly funded apartment buildings that maybe don't come through our agency. And there may or may not be some resident services attached to these kinds of buildings. Maybe there's a homework club, or there's a, you know, self-sufficiency classes, or minimal sort of case management referral systems. But it's pretty, I would say, light touch affordable housing. And then you can go deeper into providing services in a very intentional way with what we call sort of housing plus services. And so it's focused not just on the physical real estate, but also on really intentional services to help people with self-sufficiency or health issues or things of that nature. There are many times, if there's adequate funding, services really designed to help folks maintain that housing. And then there's these added pieces, if there's funding and local partnerships that work around reentry, mental health, supportive housing. Some people are very focused on alcohol and drug-free housing. And so those are kind of the range of rental housing resources available in the market. I often get asked, what do we mean by affordable? It's to some degree in the eye of the beholder, but the standard that we use at my agency and in the industry in general is this idea that you shouldn't have to pay more than 30% of your income for your housing costs. That's a national standard. It's been set, you know, at the federal level for many years. And so that's really the benchmark. And people debate that from time to time, but that's what we use. That's what federal programs are benchmarked against. And the idea, of course, that if you pay more than 30% of your income for your housing, rent, utilities, or even your mortgage, then your household budget is pretty stretched if you've got a low income. And so this benchmark becomes important, the lower your income. And we want to make sure that families and households have enough income left over to pay for other necessities. Now, a national group, the National Low Income Housing Coalition.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Wilson.
So, Margaret, when we get back there to the 30%, what do you think the percentage is of Oregonians right now that are above 30%?
I've got a slide in a minute that.
Okay, disregard.
Yes. Actually, that last I'll bullet. Wait. That last bullet.
Here we go. Yes, the last bullet on this page also has it.
Wow. Okay. Well, disregard that. Yeah. Wow.
But it's an important point. So a couple of cuts at this. This national group that studies these pieces across the country determined that in Oregon, if you are earning minimum wage, you need to work 72 hours a week in order to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment at sort of Oregon's average rents, which they found to be $846. And that's, again, assuming that somebody's aiming at that 30% benchmark. So you can see that we have this sort of wage rent imbalance problem. And then we'll drill into a little bit how does that manifest in Oregon. And indeed, one in three Oregonians actually pay more than half of their income for rent. And one in two, or half, pay more than 30% of their income towards rent. And I've got a few more statistics around this. This dynamic of paying that much is what we call rent burdened, being rent burdened or severely rent burdened. And so another sort of cut at this is how many renter households are considered extremely low income. It's a large number, as you can see here, 175,000 renter households. And there's that income varies across the state. But broad brush, there's just a fraction of the number of rental units that would be affordable to people earning that much income. So 175,000 renter households, really poor, competing, if you will, for 45,000 apartments in Oregon that are affordable, either because we've subsidized them or HUD has subsidized them, or they're just naturally affordable in the market. And so there's a big gap. The other thing we pay attention to is how many folks are receiving rent assistance or public housing, that sort of federal housing subsidy that is the best subsidy if you're poor. One in four eligible households are actually getting that subsidy. So that subsidy is administered locally by public housing authorities. There's a housing authority that covers every county, every jurisdiction in Oregon. They have waiting lists that are years long, and many of them actually close their waiting lists when they get too long, because there's no point in having people continue to sign up and with the idea that it could be 5 or 6 years.
Senator Winters.
Thanks. Ms. Van Fleet, do you have a geographical breakdown on this particular issue? Can you break it down by county?
Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, we can. I don't have that slide with me today, but I'd be happy. We'll keep track of these questions and come back and provide deeper level of detail to the committee, if that'd be all right.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
When you mention such a limit on what's available that would be helpful to people who are on the list, and so sometimes lists are even just closed because it takes too long to move up on the list, mm-hmm. Can you tell me how many areas of the state do something other than just first on the list is first come, first served versus some sort of a prioritization where if there are children involved or there's some other pressing need that suggests, in addition to shelter, there's some other critical concern to address, how that person it may jump ahead of others that have been on the list for longer. Does every area of the state have that kind of priority, or only some?
Chair Nathanson, the answer is it varies by local housing authority. It would be, I think, easy to get that data, and we'll go to our friends at the Housing Authority Association to get that data. I am most familiar with the housing authority that serves Multnomah County. They're called Home Forward, and they do have some preferences and priorities for special populations. But I'm not current on how that works, and so I think that is an important question, and we'll, let us follow up with that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. One of the things we've been trying to do in the spirit of integrating our work and thinking about our need analysis in connection with other parts of the safety net system is we've mapped where do we have folks who are severely rent burdened. 150,000 Oregonians have this severe rent burden as part of their situation. And we may overlay that with where are there concentrations of families on TANF, just as a point of sort of what's going on here with people struggling with poverty. And so I think, you know, you could drill into this kind of a data, and we're, you know, increasingly working to do that with our friends at DHS. But, for example, I think Josephine County here and Marion County, so the bigger the dot and the darker color the dot is the higher concentration of folks on TANF in that county, and the darker the shade of the county is how the more severe the rent burden problem is. So if you can begin to sort of look at where do we have just broad brush sort of these indicators of need and distress and people in poverty, I think that will be a very interesting way for us to start thinking about aligning our programs with more intention. So I'm going to come back to that in a couple of minutes.
Can I follow? Okay, so yeah. I get what you're trying to do here with this, but my understanding, we've seen a huge decrease with DHS with TANF, and I appreciate DHS really working on families with that. So there's only in the neighborhood of somewhere between, I think, 27,000 homes that are on TANF right now. How does that fit into that scheme there of 150,000 Oregonians?
Chair Nathanson and Representative Olson, I think the answer is just that there's different ways. If you're on TANF, you're probably also unstable in your housing. Or if you're unstable in your housing and you're severely rent burdened, it may be that you would qualify for TANF or other programs. And so I think it's just a way for us. I'm not drawing conclusions from this. I'm just trying to take a broad brush look at what's happening with people in poverty in different parts of the state. And could we think about different ways of kind of measuring need and distress? So I don't draw conclusions from this. We haven't taken any action based on this. We're simply trying to understand the landscape better with our friends at DHS. I don't know if that answers.
Well, I would clearly look at that. I mean, if I was into methodology and walk away thinking that you are drawing a conclusion.
Okay. That's good feedback. Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at this slide, and I'm just taking Clatsop County just to point out. It looks like it's the severe burdened percentage of the county is 26% to 36%, yet only 0 to less than 1% is on TANF. Is that right?
Yes, Chair Nathanson and Representative Boone, that's how I read that. So again, I'm not sure what conclusion to draw from
that.
That's
what I was going to ask you next.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've teed up an interesting question, and I'm sorry I don't have the answer for it.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
That's
yeah.
going to be interesting.
Okay. So the other sort of set of questions I frequently get is, well, aren't we, you know, recovering? Isn't the economy recovering? Are we coming out of the worst of the problem? I think folks will recognize that it's an uneven economic recovery across the state. And while the recovery is good news in some ways, for the real estate market, it tends to drive prices up pretty fast. And we know there are some markets, it's not universal, but in some places in Oregon, home prices and rental rates are really going up very quickly because of increasing demand. And so that's putting pressure on vacancies. There are fewer and fewer apartments available for people to rent. In Central Oregon, perhaps you've heard, they have a really frighteningly low vacancy rate, less than 1%, which is really troubling. And people are, you know, we hear stories of dozens of people showing up for one vacant, you know, duplex or apartment. And that's also true increasingly in parts of the Portland metro area. And so I think this, the economic recovery, while in some places the private sector will come behind in response to these changing real estate state dynamics and add more inventory, for poor people that's not necessarily going to be helpful because they're going to be, those private sector players are going to be delivering product at market rents. and that's not going to help people who are struggling in poverty. And then, of course, the housing choice vouchers compete in that market with fewer and fewer vacancies. And so what housing authorities are telling us is that when somebody gets to the top of the waiting list, they get a voucher. They have a certain number of weeks to go rent an apartment with that voucher, and increasingly families can't find an apartment, so they come back and say, I'm sorry, I can't use the voucher, and so they have to turn it back in. So that turnback rate for vouchers is a really startling thing that housing authorities face, and it just speaks to this lack of available apartments and rentals.
Thank you. Really quickly, and you may have a slide about this later on, but do we also have an issue with distance between affordable housing and where people work? I mean, people may be able to find something sometimes, but it's an hour and a half or 2 hour commute by public transit to their work site.
Yeah.
Are you going to be talking about that at all, or do you want to talk about that now?
Chair Nathanson and Senator Steiner Hayward, we don't have specific data, but we do have lots of anecdotes that get at that, and my presentation doesn't actually cover that today. But we certainly know, for example, in Bend, we hear about people who, you know, anybody from a Starbucks barista to a hospital worker, they're commuting long distances, or they're living in their car camping while they're waiting to find something.
Yeah.
That's true on the coast as well. We've heard about, you know, the vacation rental dynamic really distorting what's available for low-income renters. So we know anecdotally, we haven't studied it specifically.
It's a concern of mine.
Yeah.
It's certainly true in the metro area.
Yes.
The metro area.
Yes. So this just is another way of sort of saying, in some ways, the same thing, that the increasing rental prices, the market is really taking off. Vacancies are fewer and fewer in many, many places. It's troubling. And the other thing I would point out here is that people with any kind of barrier are going to be the hardest hit. So if you have any sort of negative rental history, if you paid your rent late a few times, you're going to have a negative rental history. If there's any dings on your credit report, if you've come out of corrections, if you have any, you know, any sort of anything that could be considered negative by a landlord, it's going to be even harder for you to compete. And we know that people in poverty often have those kinds of barriers. And so that is a huge problem. So I'm going to pivot and really just talk a few minutes about the agency and what role we play and are trying to play going forward.
Ms. Van Vliet,
yes.
Senator Winters has it.
You mentioned the barriers to in corrections, mm-hmm. and you know, as a state policy, we're actually devoting a lot of not only resources but a policy on reentry, which is corrections, and along with that, the parallel with that is the whole issue of the mentally ill and those, and I, you know, I know that you're drilling in on TANF. Is there plans going forward to begin drilling in on those two categories as well? Because Senator Bates and I have talked at length, mm-hmm. about the need to actually come together for these three. You know, we tend to do things in one program without looking at the intersecting of really all three issues, really.
Yeah.
So I just wonder, you know, in the future, you know, what your thoughts are, and where there's barriers, the probability of us being able to actually begin to start removing some of them.
Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, it's a great question. We've recently done in my agency kind of a big look at what's our role in the state. In the state scheme of housing and anti-poverty work. We recast a new strategic sort of direction, and one of the most important strategic imperatives that we've carved out for ourselves is to really become data and research driven, and another one is to really sort of drive that alignment. And so we're not positioned there yet. It's my hope and my commitment that we will do that, that we will increasingly invest our resources. They're scarce. People have to compete for all of our money, and I'll show you a little bit about that in a minute. And that what I'm committed to is really, when we hold a competition, that we're really targeting our resources in the most impactful ways, and that we're integrating our work much more and getting out of our silo. And so that's a theme that I take very seriously. And so we're not there yet, but I think we're making important strides, and I appreciate your interest in that. I would also just mention that I am pleased to serve on the Governor's Reentry Council, and so I'm a participant in those conversations and working to sort of further that.
So. Just follow up. I have pulled together a cross systems group of directors to actually begin drilling in on some of these very issues, because finding that both corrections as well as mental health as well as your mm-hmm. outfit, that it continually yep. these subjects keep coming up about the availability or the barriers that right. exist for these population groups, whether we're talking mental health or talking corrections and what have you. So I'm very grateful that you're going to begin drilling into this.
Yeah, thank you. So here's just a quick view of sort of how we see ourselves. We really do want to position the state to achieve economic security, and specifically by being very intentional about the housing system and integrating our policy. We want to really serve more people more effectively within the housing system, and that's that's what we aspire to do. We're not there yet, but it's certainly the direction I've carved out for the agency. This is a little bit of an overwhelming chart, so the details are not what's most critical here. But what I would say about this is this really depicts the role the agency plays in the broader system. And the takeaway here is we're an intermediary. We are a bank. We do housing finance in some ways like a public bank. We get a variety of federal funds. We get a variety of state funds. We package those. We send them back out to others. We are not anybody's landlord. We don't own any real estate. That could change in the future, but we'll leave that aside. But this is just to really be clear about what role we play within the broader housing system. And the piece I point out on the left of this is, again, on the federal side, there's one of the best sets of sets of subsidies for very poor people, and when it comes to housing, go directly to public housing authorities from HUD. And we don't play any role in that. We try and partner with them, but sometimes that's a point of confusion, and we're not in that mix. They get their money directly from HUD, and so there's that. Just as a snapshot within that housing finance system, over the last 5 years, we've financed close to 8,000 units, 222 projects in almost all counties of the state. And so you can see that sort of the darker the county coloring on the map, the bigger the investment. We feel like we're achieving pretty good geographic diversity. It's a constant focus for us in our policy body is the State Housing Council, and they press us judiciously on that point. And so just as a way of sort of looking at our impact, the other thing I'd say about this is we routinely turn away two or even three projects for every one that we're able to finance. So we're required by our federal funds to hold competitions of some sort. So we offer notices of funding availability. And people subscribe to that, and we are constantly turning away really good, really needed, very viable projects. And so that's a whole other piece of this that I want to get more intentional about, is how do we set up the competition? And I think we've made good progress. I think there's more to go. How do we set up the competition in a way that we're really driving state priorities with these kinds of resources? The other half of our agency, besides housing finance funds, is what we call housing stabilization funds. Again, we're an intermediary. In this case, we're not like so much a bank. We're not financing real estate. We are administering federal and state grants. And for the most part, those funds go out to the community action agencies that cover all counties in the state. And that's a picture of the 17 community action agencies covering our 36 counties. I want you to hear from other people, so I'm going to speed this up a little bit. A couple things I wanted to point out that we're doing in the spirit of integrating our work and trying to align it. We did a big restructure. The agency is smaller than it was 3 years ago when I got here, but we did carve out a couple of positions and created something new called a housing integrator with the express purpose of really getting outside of that silo and really trying to align with the other parts of state government. It's early, but we feel like there's some really nice connections being made there. And I said this before, but I think it bears repeating. If we can get savvy about financing the right real estate in the right places, then we'll let the human service, the health, the reentry folks bring their folks and their resources into that real estate. And I think that's the right role for us long term, is that, you know, we don't want to presume to know how best to serve TANF clients or people, you know, who are reentering society. But if we can get really good at the real estate and be really savvy about that, then I think that serves as an asset for those other systems.
Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Just in terms of alignment, one or two slides back, you had the picture of the different community partners, mm-hmm. and in the bottom was the orange, which was the food network.
Yes.
So you might mention that there's a transition.
Yes, thank you.
In that partnership.
I wonder if I can do this. I probably don't need to go back. So the state's general fund contribution to the Oregon Food Bank and a couple of other smaller food security related programs actually run through my agency, and there was good reason for that when it was set up many years ago. We have, as part of our restructure and what's proposed in the governor's budget, is that those would transfer to DHS and let them work on food security. We think that's probably a better long-term fit. So that's working its way through the system.
Is the integrator mm-hmm. in the room with us today?
Madam Chair, the integrator is not in the room with us today.
We may be listening.
Yes, probably listening. There's two of them.
Okay.
You would like them very much. quick word about pending legislation. You may have heard about the proposal for a substantial new $100 million investment in affordable housing. For me, this is really this opportunity to drive a production agenda and to really create a, you know, really jumpstart the production of affordable rental housing. That will get more conversation as session proceeds, and be happy to come and talk with any of you sort of offline about our thoughts about that. We have some materials that are, I think, pretty good at describing our approach and how we're seeing the opportunity there. But really, if we do this, if we make a substantial new investment of bonding resources into housing, I think it's really an opportunity to drive even further these alignment themes, to really be very intentional about how we set up whatever competition we want to look at and not have it be driven by federal rules, and that we can really do this real estate well and again have human service and other agencies help us make sure the right families get to live in those apartments. So this concludes my presentation. I know you have a few other folks to hear from. So I will, unless there's questions right now, I'll step back. And
yes, but please do stay in
yes,
the room.
Yes, of course, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are we moving to addictions and mental health next? Thank you. Mr. Morris.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. I'm Mike Morris, and I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator with the Addictions and Mental Health Division within the Oregon Health Authority. So I'm here to talk about as far as our role in housing and how we administer housing development and rental assistance and also our coordination with other agencies. So we see housing as an integral part of an individual's recovery from mental illness as well as alcohol and drug. You can provide all the state-of-the-art treatment, but if you're sending people back home to very unstable situations or unhealthy situations, it kind of devalues the treatment that the individual receives. So it's really crucial that we are very focused on housing and making sure that individuals, as much as possible, have that opportunity for safe and clean and sober housing. So what I'll do in this presentation is we, as you understand, we do provide a lot of services for individuals, and some of those services are within housing situations, but for the sake of this presentation, we'll focus on the development and how we are involved in developing housing and making housing available for the population that we serve. So towards the end of the presentation, I'll talk about some interesting constraints that we have around housing as it relates to the Olmstead decision. So there are several types of ways that we are involved in housing. The first one are licensed adult residential programs, and so we'll talk about those. That's the where treatment is provided within those facilities. Then we'll talk about supportive housing. Then we'll talk about rental assistance. And then we'll also talk about a new grant that we received in partnership with Oregon Housing and Community Services, the HUD 811 grant. So licensed adult mental health residential, these are primarily funded with caseload growth dollars. And we, with those funds, we look at, oftentimes we look at the individuals that are at the state hospital, because that's a primary focus, is making sure that individuals who are in the state hospital have the opportunity to move to the community as soon as possible. So we're looking at the programmatic needs of individuals in the hospital as well as in higher residential systems, and then looking at particular clinical needs and populations that we have to serve. And then we look at geographically where is a place and the need for those services. So we then have a competitive application every biennium. Based upon we will need a certain type of program in a certain area serving this particular population, and the people respond to those requests for applications. And then what our funding for the caseload growth is, as far as the development side, we fund the acquisition as well as the remodeling of facilities, and then also the furnishing and startup of those programs. We also, part of our funding for caseload growth is provide to fund the services within that facility. So just to give you kind of an idea as far as the type of facilities that I'm talking about, is we have our secure residential treatment facilities, which are six beds or more in a locked facility. Then we have residential treatment facilities, which are like secure residential. They're more than six beds, but they are not locked or secured. And then we have what we refer to as residential treatment homes, and those are five beds or less. We provide residential services within that that home. And so that's why we call our residential treatment home, as opposed to another licensed facility that we license and fund, and that's adult foster homes. Adult foster homes focus primarily on the daily care of an individual for basic needs, and then treatment is delivered in the community. So those are the type of facilities that we fund, develop, and license. We have about 276 of those facilities across the state. So,
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, how does somebody get into one of these for the alcohol and drug treatment? How would they go about getting applying for it?
So, Chair Nathanson and Representative Boone, the facilities that I'm referring to here are mental health facilities. So these are individuals with mental illness and not a focus of alcohol and drug, although some of those individuals have alcohol and drug problems that they are being addressed within those facilities. And those referrals come through the community from the state hospital, and also CCOs are involved in referrals to those programs.
If someone doesn't have a mental health issue but does have alcoholism and needs, let's say, coming out of prison or whatever, jail, how would they, can they access any of these?
Not these particular facilities, but as far as alcohol and drug treatment facilities, those are, across the state, and those are funded by a variety of, there are sometimes contracts with corrections. There are, of course, it's a CCO Medicaid benefit, and so they get referral through that system for treatment, and as well as other community agencies making referrals.
And just one final. And how long does that process take? Is it a long process? They have to go then, say they're just coming out and they don't have a place to live, and they do they go to their CCO and ask for this, ask for help? Not quite clear on how you'd go about getting into one of these for the alcohol.
You know, we have several slides later on that. Can we we cover it then?
So. Okay,
thank
great.
You.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm wanting to make sure we get through all of them.
Just a quick question, and we may be getting to it, but in the mental health residential treatment facilities and those that you listed, what is your current capacity versus what is your need? And hopefully we're going to get someplace in these slides, we're going to talk about capacity, the availability versus what is your actual need for this population.
Okay. Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, in regards to residential facilities, we have, and this is, we have firm data. We can provide that data regarding in each of these levels, the residential treatment facilities, et cetera. We can provide that capacity. I can tell you that this capacity is nearly full all the time. We can give you specific percentages of occupancy. So we are in the process of working with the Medicaid system, because Medicaid funds a large portion of the services in these facilities, and we're working with within OHA to move that benefit, the residential benefit, into the CCOs, so it's managed by the CCOs, so that there's more efficient and effective utilization of those beds. Sometimes we're concerned that people get stuck in one type of facility and the movement to lower levels of care isn't happening as efficiently as it could happen, and to maximize our capacity. We are also working with our forecasting unit within OHA to develop a new forecasting methodology to look at the need for the mandated population that would then drive us to a better estimate of what needs to happen in the case of growth.
Thank you. Follow-up, will you, and is there still the issue of one, not in my backyard, particularly on the residential facility side, and particularly talking about the PSRB, the mentally ill that are coming through from the forensic side, is that still a problem?
Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, that continues to be an issue. I would like to say that it is improved in a sense that we and our providers have learned from previous experience and difficult experiences in working with neighborhoods and how to and at what point to bring the neighborhood into the discussion and to develop good neighbor agreements, et cetera. But I would not say that that issue is totally gone away. Okay. The other type of housing, and this is development of supported and supportive housing. I want to make a note here. We'll get into it in a few slides later, but and I'll explain the differences between supported and supportive housing and some issues around that. So you'll see in the slides that I'll you'll see those terms used, but I'll explain it further later. So this is actually the development of the housing itself. So it's the construction and building of this. This is what I'm referring to here. And so we provide funding through a variety of sources for, right now we have 794 units that we have contributed to the development of those programs. In the future, we will, and again, I'll talk about this later, as far as we will be targeting supported housing with the ED. And then we also have alcohol and drug properties, which we have a competitive process for the construction and development of alcohol and drug-free housing. And we have about 380 units that we have funded over time. The other part of supported housing is more in the assistance for individuals to get into existing stock of housing, and that is through our rental assistance program. This is a new program through some of the mental health investment dollars that we received, which includes both general fund and tobacco tax. And we were able to fund 576 slots for rental assistance. And this is includes $500 for assistance in the rent, as well as $1,000 per individual to remove barriers to get into the housing, which includes everything from clearing up some past debts, you know, with utilities, et cetera, and doing first and last month, and some initial assistance in getting, you know, furniture or pots and pans and those kind of type of things to make them successful in the housing. So we also have alcohol and drug rental assistance that we administer. And so we provide 637 families with rental assistance, as well as 719 with housing counseling, so assistance in locating and finding housing out there. So. One of the things that, in regards to...
Senator Bates has a question.
And the question I'm going to ask you to try to get to is offline on. Senator Winder started the question, and I don't think necessarily you understood the question. The question is this. What do you think the need is, and what are your capacities right now, and where are those capacities located in the state? That's the key question here. As we try to build a new mental health system, housing is a big part of it. We call it the back door. Front door is going to be the new mental health facilities out of the ED, out of the jails, into that. When they come out of that facility, what I keep hearing from all of these people is the back door is inadequate. There's no place to send them on a routinely funded and understandable way to get the right housing and the right level of care when they move out. And so we're not going to fix the system that way. They're going to circle right back around within a few months by coming off the streets and going back to the system. So the question we need from you is not that you built 576 different facilities somewhere in the state. The real question is measure the need first, make sure it's right geographically, make sure the fit's right, and then we can talk about how we're going to build it out and what those should look like and what kind of facilities they should be and what kind of counseling and support should be there. That's what makes sense to us up here. That, and I don't want that answer now. Like you and Pam get together and give us a map on it.
Chair Nathanson, Senator Bates, you're absolutely right. And so we are working with our director, Len Saxton, on the mapping of our system, and housing is an aspect of that, and looking at the housing that's available. We have we are actually within the last couple weeks in regards to supported housing, that level started discussions with Oregon Housing and Community Services to quantify the need for that level of housing to be able to guide us in further development. And also in regards to the residential system and the need in the back door, in the back door getting clogged up as far as people not having the place to go to and leave the state hospital in a timely fashion. There are two ways you can do it. And when one is to address that issue, one in the last 15 years, we've been building out the residential system. So we've been doing a lot of construction and building and development of programs. We, in recent biennia, we've slowed that down and really targeted which particular populations need, a specific type of facility. But we believe we're at the point where it's not just a matter that where you can, quote unquote, build your way out of it. That is more about how those resources are being used. And that is why the focus on, one, mapping and identifying the need more clearly, and then also working with to move the residential benefit over to the CCOs to let that be managed within the whole system of care will, we believe, will facilitate the better utilization of the stock and the resources we have. But we are looking at being able to better quantify the need, and that includes the stuff I've already referenced as far as the mapping exercise, but also we've been working on the forecasting and the methodology for that to have a better idea, more data sound way of actually forecasting the need into the future.
I'll take any more time, keep rolling.
Okay, the I just want to mention this is a grant that we applied for last year in partnership with Oregon Housing and Community Services applied for the grant. We partnered with them, and this is, we just were notified recently that Oregon was awarded this grant. It's to provide, the HUD 811 program is to provide rental assistance for individuals with disabilities, and so that's the target population of that federal program. And so we within AMH will be administering in 40 of those slots in that program, and we think that the program, part of it depends on the negotiation with the feds to get everything set up, but we're looking to start this program in 2016.
Great. To be fair to the other presenters, and to make sure we get the comprehensive view, I think you're going to have to find a way to fly through the rest of this in about 3 minutes.
Sure.
But we do have the slides in front of us to see all the words, even if you skip over some of the words.
So the one thing I just want to raise as far as the issue that it's a constraint, it's not a barrier, and that is with our community system is being reviewed, investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice, and we have a letter of agreement regarding our relationship with them, and part of that is collecting data and reporting data. I won't go into the full agreement or regarding that data collection and reporting, but one of the things that we talked about in that, and there's some confusion in the community, we've done a lot of conversations with in the community as well as our federal partners to outside of USDOJ to understand what the implications are. And so the U.S. Department of Justice, in as far as the Olmstead Supreme Court decision, is what they refer to as an integration mandate. And so for housing, they're looking for individuals with mental illness to be in the most integrated setting possible. And so to kind of facilitate the data collection, they more clearly defined what that was. And their definition is that in a complex of multiple units is that you would not have any more than 20% of those units being occupied by individuals with mental illness. And so that is the implications of that is
it's data collection right now, but we understand from the data collection, our discussions with them, that's what they want to see being developed. And so that is our focus, is housing that meets that definition. So we also wanted to, we thought it was important to collect information about the other kind of supportive housing. And so we have two definitions within the U.S. Department of Justice agreement. One is for supported housing, and the other is supportive housing. And so here's the description of it. The main difference is that supported is in what's referred to as scattered sites, so it's across in general housing. Supportive housing could be in scattered site, but it also could be in congregate, where you have a large complex with multiple units, and it's all dedicated to individuals with mental illness or with alcohol and drug issues. This is from our report, the U.S. Department of Justice, talking about those two different populations, and currently what we what our numbers as far as individuals being served in that area. We do have some growth in our supportive housing. So there's a note there, and I'll just reference it. You can look at it. But we did do a 2005 survey, housing survey, that talked about the need. And there's combined, there's over 7,000 that are at that time needed some type of housing. These are individuals with mental illness. So as far as this is just the discussion regarding our procurement and that, how we administer the funds is a competitive process.
We're going to have to move on to the next presentations. Could you please get to slide 14 and spend no more than 1 minute just reviewing your partnership with Housing and Community Services?
And so so as far as we have been in close discussions with Oregon Housing and Community Services regarding our funding, the funding that we've got, we've been trying to work with them as far as lining up our application process so that, you know, developers use our funding as well as other types of funding, and we try to line up our process so when they submit an application, they can talk about the multiple sources of funding for us as well as Oregon Housing Community Services. And then you see, as far as I talked about some of these other things, we do have Oregon Housing Community Services staff on some of our advisory committees and that are looking at Olmsted issue and housing issues and so that.
Thank you, and I am particularly interested in the point on opportunities to align the application processes. I think it probably just drives people crazy in the community. Are they supposed to apply to one or two or three different state agencies and at different times of year? And it's extra work for all of you, and it's extra work for the organizations in the community. So that's one I will probably ask about in the future. How's it going?
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to hear next from Mr. Erickson. Is that right? Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and committee members, and thank you for the time this morning. I'm going to alter my presentation just a little bit in light of the time and also in light of some of the questions that I've heard so far. And I'm going to kind of jump to the end and give you a real quick summary that we have in developmental disabilities. Oh, excuse me, My name is Don Erickson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Developmental Disabilities and Aging and Disabilities. We have three housing programs in developmental disabilities. We have our KIPP homes, which I'll describe, which is a group home setting. We have housing vouchers that we rent vouchers that we provide to our folks. And we now have the option of utilizing the K-Plan to create home modifications for folks who live in their own home but require some modification in order to remain there and to remain safe and comfortable. And I want to go ahead and just share with you that of the three programs, we have capacity right now, adequate capacity for our KIPP homes and for K-Plan home modifications. The one area that we continue to struggle with a wait list is rent vouchers. And again, we've been fortunate to be named partners with the HUD grant that was just discussed, and we're anticipating adding 40 vouchers for our folks in 2016. Our wait list for vouchers runs about between 50 and 60 at any given time. And so if we were to have those additional 40 vouchers today, we would certainly be able to make a significant impact on the current wait list for those services. So with that, I'll progress efficiently through our presentation. Again, the three housing programs that we offer through developmental disabilities is the Community Integration Program, which is referred to as KIPP Homes, Rent Subsidy, and K-Plan Home Modifications. The KIPP Homes came about with the closing of the Fairview State Training Center, and the upshot was about approximately 200 homes were created to provide housing for Fairview residents. This was called the Community Housing Project, or again referred to as KIPP. The mission of the KIPP project was again to provide for DHS to oversee the KIPP homes, making sure that the homes are kept in structurally sound condition and are as comfortable and up-to-date as possible. These homes are designed for 24-hour care. These are group home settings, and they've served the community, I think, very well for many years. As we'll talk about, we're sort of reaching a time for change or for evaluation of change in this particular housing option. The homes are owned by 16 nonprofit housing providers and have a total capacity of 871. That's a little bit deceptive in the sense that that's what the homes are approved for, anywhere from 5 to, I believe, the maximum is 7 individuals sharing the home. And as, again, I'll move forward here, that the trend has been over the last, especially the last few years, for the provider agencies, the folks who are actually providing supportive services for these folks, to prefer a smaller census in the homes for folks who have higher needs. And so the trend has been moving towards, instead of 5 occupants or 5 renters in the home, 3 folks in the homes, and again with those folks having higher needs than had previously been the case. This still makes the homes financially viable for the owners, but makes the overall service delivery, again, more manageable for the provider community. At the present time, community housing, our office, Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, continues to provide annual assessment for each home, structural assessment, where we go in and we do a top-to-bottom assessment of the home. And again, we're looking for structural issues and again, plumbing, electrical, the works, to make sure the homes are completely functional and safe. We also then provide services if there's damage to a home for whatever reason. We provide funding and assistance to for maintenance and repair on an ongoing basis. For these homes, we also provide funding for what's called care and custody, meaning that there was concern years back of if I'm a homeowner and I only have, and I'm approved for 5 residents, but I'm down to 3 residents because of vacancies for a variety of reasons, the state would then supplement that homeowner to ensure that the home was financially viable. While we look for another individual to fill that vacancy. Community housing expanded and adapted homes for children and adults in crisis. These homes are operated by our stabilization and crisis unit, also sometimes referred to as SACU. At the present time, there are 23 homes operated by the stabilization and crisis unit, providing housing for 78 adults and 10 children. And again, this is considered temporary housing. And when the crisis has subsided, then individuals are, again, they look for ongoing, more permanent housing for these folks, or return to their original home, ideally. The current trends with the KIPP homes, as I mentioned, is for a shift to a lower number of, to fewer residents in the group homes. And for those folks to be of have higher needs or higher acuity, and again, this has we've been able to maintain capacity for availability for the KIPP group home settings. Some of the changes that we're looking at is that again, this program was developed many years ago, and many of the mortgages will begin to mature in 2017. And at that point, the financial assistance provided by the state technically stops. That the homeowners are no longer obliged to contract with the Department of Developmental Disabilities. And we are, again, no longer obligated to maintain maintenance and care and custody services for those folks. And so we've been looking at or trying to project what's that going to mean, that our homeowners going to choose to no longer contract with us. And what are the implications of that? So we're very excited about the potential for Senate Bill 617, task force that's being developed to look at housing over the next year and see what kind of creative ideas come from that group. There is the possibility that and we're trying to, again, to pin this down in statute or in the records of the KIPP homes, that if a homeowner chooses not to contract with the Department of Human Services after the mortgage matures, that we are responsible for returning that home back to condition to be sold on the market. And the estimates for reconverting a home back to market condition is anywhere from $20,000 to $40,000 per home. It's quite a project, and so again, that's an issue that's very high on our concern list.
We will not have time to spend that much time on all of your remaining slides because we're good. Almost done with the time available for your part of this. I apologize. That's this is all interesting and important for us to know. If you could pick just 2 more slides to tell us about,
absolutely.
What would be the 2 you just pick a couple, and we will read the rest of them.
I don't get that.
I would say the summary is
please
probably
do that,
best
and then we may have some questions.
Chair Nathanson. All right, very good. Again, we offer 3 housing options through developmental disabilities, the rent voucher program, the KIPP homes, and the K-Plan services. And the K-Plan services is the one that I just haven't really touched on. What K-Plan offers is the opportunity to have home modifications with a annual cap at $5,000 per member. And we actually receive a request for a home modification. We have builders who go and do an assessment and review the application and look for an appropriate contractor to actually finish the home modification as it's designated. This really does represent, and this is the summary, this represents what we see as a trend at the present time and certainly into the future, where most of our folks really want to live independently. Their preference would be to live, again, in their family home or in their own home, where they can they're freer to come and go and have folks over and live as independently as possible. The voucher program lends itself to that goal, and the K-Plan home modifications lend itself to that goal. So I think our challenge in the coming decade is going to be how do we enhance that option for the folks that we serve.
Thank you. Are there questions for this part of the presentation? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now there are the final two.
Madam Chair, I appreciate getting us through this. I mean, I have a million questions, but we never
Thank
get
you.
Through it.
And
what this tells us is these are siloed programs that don't function together. We need to take a longer look at this. There's not enough time today, but thank you for leading us through this quickly.
Thank you, sir.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson. My name is Jerry Wayburn. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency. With me today is Kim Fredlin, the Deputy Director for Self-Sufficiency. My apologies, but I'll race through this presentation and just try to touch on the highlights for you. As you know, this is the self-sufficiency program. We provide a range of services to both the working poor and those that are in extreme poverty. It is an eligibility-based program, and if you look at slide two, you will see that actually we have cutoffs. This is for a family of three. And the example we provide here is for the SNAP program, ERDC, Employment-Related Daycare, and TANF. TANF is actually the only program we have that offers any type of support for housing. And we put this slide in here to show you that for a family of three, the cutoff point, at which point a family is no longer eligible for TANF is, in terms of income, is $616 a month. The TANF program does provide a monthly payment to assist families. There's also a stipend. We give $1 million, I believe, to the Housing and Stabilization Program to assist families that are in homeless to try to prevent them from transitioning to TANF. The clients themselves, we did a focus group during 2014, and they said they described how the TANF program simply doesn't cover the cost of housing. And in fact, the numbers we have seem to show that only about 20% of our families are in public housing or get subsidized housing, but 85% of the respondents in a survey in 2011 said they struggle to pay rent or to meet their utility bills. We have a slide that talks about the one-third paradigm, that one-third of your income should go to housing. And to make that point, you'll see in the following slide, we broke that down, which would say the family on TANF of three would have about $150 to pay for their rent, the one-third, the 30% category. The issue that we have for our families is that when families aren't safe and stable.
I'm going to stop you for a moment. That's a breathtaking piece of information. Can we back up to that slide? Mm-hmm. I think we have time to just pause for a moment and look at that one more time. A $506 monthly TANF grant for a family of three.
And only 37% of federal poverty line.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative. The TANF reinvestment proposal discusses that exit eligibility being increased from 37% up to roughly 66%, which would take that to closer, little, so it wouldn't be such a cliff fall off, take it a little over $1,000 a month on that, and would help with that a bit. So just thought I'd throw that out there.
Thank you.
We were describing on page 7.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I apologize. Yes. Can we go back one more minute, Mr. Weybrandt? The other thing I would point out about that slide is the transportation piece of it. If you're only supposed to be spending 10% of your monthly take home on transportation, and that leaves $50.60 for folks in this position, and we've already talked about how the fact that affordable housing is getting further and further out, with gas at about $3 a gallon, roughly speaking, and bus fare at $3 a pop, I mean, that is not going to get somebody to and from work if they have to travel any distance whatsoever, even if they could find housing in by hook or by crook that they could afford at all on this. And it just highlights the interrelationship between these two problems. We want people to get back on their feet, to reach self-sufficiency, and yet there are enormous barriers to them doing so. I think it's really important to highlight that those two things really go hand in hand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll let you finish your,
sorry.
Slides. Again, recognizing the time, I would like to, as a side comment, Co-Chair Nathanson and Senator Bates just mentioned that last month, the approximately 30,000 families on TANF, over 1,300 of them found employment. And so the families that we have in general really strive to find employment as a key piece to their safe and their safety and the stability that they're for their families. And as you can see from our slides, they're really challenged by the level of support, especially the support we have around housing for that. When the bulk of the cash assistance is spent on housing, there's less money and opportunity for parents to prepare to find and to retain and gain employment, which really impacts negatively impacts those families and those children for the future. So we wanted to throw in a slide where we're talking about the increasing collaboration we have across housing and across mental health as we begin to talk about this interesting paradigm that our families are finding themselves in. Again, I would like to comment that we focused on the TANF program, which really is around extreme poverty. There are supports for those that are the working poor when you talk about the SNAP program and ERDC. But as Senator Steiner Hayward so eloquently pointed out, the challenge is there for those families also to move themselves to the next rung in terms of their living capabilities.
Okay. Thank you. I was passed a question that let me see if I can interpret what the question is going to be for you.
Madam Chair, while you're doing that, can I ask a few questions?
Yes, Senator.
I'll fill
please.
A gap here. We're like dead
Thank
air.
You.
So going back to your slide about a family of three, this brings into a whole bunch of questions for us, and one that goes all the way from minimum wage changes to what we're doing with health care. This slide is slightly, to me, misleading, and I know you don't mean it that way. No one survives in TANF alone, obviously. Okay, mm-hmm. The costs that are really difficult for these people, I think, are housing, transportation, and utilities. Those ones are hard to get subsidies for, hard to work with. They get a lot of help from SNAP. Their health care benefits are zero. At least should be nearly zero under the Affordable Care Act expansion, so you take that off the deck here too. When we try to weave this together in a way that gets people into self-sufficiency, because it's siloed up, it's just a mishmash. We know the housing, we learned a little bit about an hour and a half here today, is a mess. Okay, we got different programs all over the place for different groups of people, and probably there's a lot of overlap. That's one issue we're gonna have to deal with no matter what we do with the rest of it. We're very concerned about the cliff as far as a minimum wage is concerned. I would think that a minimum wage increase in this group, and as you mentioned, many of them gone to work, my guess is they've gone to work for minimum wage. And they're going to be pushing up against some barriers here that will tell them, don't work, go back back on TANF, we're back where we need to go to make this work for themselves. Have you kind of looked at what it looks like as far as what kind of jobs they're picking up and what they're being paid in those jobs? Are they going to just $9 an hour? What's happening here?
Chair Bates, Chair Nathanson, the rest of the committee, we actually have done an analysis of that, and we can get those breakdowns for you. We also look at what we set wage goals and measure those. For example, one of our wage goals is families to actually be making $11.55 an hour, and we've got a measurement, and we can provide that to you, the number of the families that actually achieve that. Many of the jobs these families are finding are entry-level jobs and service-level jobs, and so they struggle not just because of the minimum wage, but they struggle because they're not full-time jobs. The economy is generating part-time employment where they continue to need subsidies or supports in order for them to meet their bills while they're trying to get to work.
Good point. Forgot that one. Thank you. You got your question ready? Can you buy enough time?
Thank you very much, Senator. How do any of your programs relate to assisting survivors of domestic violence?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, and the rest of the committee, we actually have a specific program for domestic violence victims that provides them with supportive services, including assisting them with emergency housing. I believe we actually gave, in our overview of the program, there's actually detailed information. If you'd like us to resend that to you, we'd be happy to do that.
Yes, could you please send that as a separate response? I'd appreciate it. Thank you. And also, can we return to slide 8, again with a focus on collaboration? I appreciate seeing slides like this. I think it addresses some of what Senator Bates has been discussing. In addition to the things noted on here, transportation has been mentioned as a cost. What information might you have about what transportation assistance is available through, for example, Chariots or Lane Transit District or in the Portland metro area? Are there city or local transit agencies that provide discounted rates, for example, for monthly passes? What help is there, and how do people find out about transportation assistance?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, rest of the committee, I don't believe there are discounted rates, but we can research that for you and get that information to you.
And I realize this is a discussion about housing, but we are trying to also address the problem. If you're having trouble making ends meet, what is it we're doing to help with any of that? So sometime in the future, if you could get us a little information, we'd appreciate it. Are there any final questions? And I'm guilty of asking a non-housing question, but anything related to our set of housing presentations this morning?
There are a million, but we can't
talk about
a million. This is just a mess.
Just love to put child care on the record. We are in the tax credit committee really trying to look at child care in relation to the other subsidy programs like TANF and build in some refundability on the tax care credit so that TANF people, as they're trying to get back to work, have some support in recognizing what the cliff is, and also to the degree that child care can be built into housing projects to make it easier for working families to have child care near where they live. Just want to get that on the record.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you all for being with us today. Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.
What we got to you?
Thank you.
What we got to you?